Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass with a foreign policy for less threatening times. He calls it the Restoration Doctrine. It's in his new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. Mr. Haass, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be back.
And before we get your proposals for getting our domestic house in order, I was struck by the premise that leads to your conclusions, that these are relatively unthreatening times for the United States. Can you start there and tell us how you judge that?
Sure. Look at the last century just to begin. In the 20th century, history was essentially defined by two world wars and then by a Cold War, where the United States had countries or faced countries of at least equal capacity who were also quite hostile towards who we were and what we stood for. Now, by contrast, in the 21st century, I don't see that. I don't see any country now or for the foreseeable future that will be anything like in our overall league in terms of strength. More important, none of the potential countries of considerable strength wakes up in the morning feeling tremendous animosity towards the United States, that somehow we stand in the way of their destiny. So I'm not sitting here saying we don't face all sorts of threats, be it medium-sized states or weak states or from global challenges like climate change or proliferation, but simply that nothing rises to what you might call the level of an existential threat to the United States.
Do you think do you think that the anxiety level around the country is a mismatch with reality? I mean, we just had Boston, of course, which was the worst attack on U.S. soil since 9/11. People worry about Iran on the verge of becoming a nuclear power, I think mostly because they have the potential to want to share the technology with terrorists. I'm not sure people are less anxious today than they were during the Cold War.
Well, I mean, there's reasons to have levels of anxiety. I'm just trying to put it in perspective. I also think that the kinds of challenges we face in things like Boston, which are real, but those are more internal challenges dealing with the radicalization of particularly elements of our youth, often from the internet. That's not necessarily a challenge we're going to meet with traditional foreign policy.
Should I conclude then that you were happy with President Obama's, I think, historic speech last week, basically declaring an end to the war on terror?
I'm happy with the thrust of the speech. I thought he went a little bit too far in talking about an end to the war on terror because it's almost like battling disease. We're never going to – never's a long time, but I can't foresee the day when we will see an end to terror. But I do think the president is right in basically saying that counterterrorism cannot be the defining principle of America's role in the world.
You were an advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell under George W. Bush, but you seem to argue in your book that the central parts of the Bush-Powell response to 9/11 was an overreaction or were overreactions, including Afghanistan, not just Iraq. Is that what you think today?
Well, I believe Afghanistan was right initially. I thought the United States had every right to demand the ouster of Al-Qaeda from the country, and then when the Taliban government refused to do so, the United States had every right to act as it did to remove the Taliban government from power. But I thought the United States did not have grounds for launching the war in Iraq. I don't think our vital national interests were at stake. I thought we had other policies that were perfectly good. And I don't think the Obama administration was essentially correct when it tripled U.S. force levels in Afghanistan and decided to try to remake the country. So I don't think either nation-building effort in Iraq or Afghanistan was warranted.
So one of the recommendations in your book is to eschew or at least to de-emphasize a foreign policy focus on the Middle East. Can we really do that if Iran and Middle East-based Islamist radicalism are the main national security threats from abroad?
Well, I'm not sure they are the main national security threats. In terms of Middle Eastern radicalism, I don't see any signs that American intervention in many cases is going to be able to change the immediate course of what the radicals pose. In the case of Iran, I do think the nuclear issue is a big foreign policy choice, and it's arguably the one that that is faces the biggest test to what it is I'm advocating. But I would actually argue the biggest national security threat for the foreseeable future, and one that the United States is well suited to deal with besides the domestic, is the shifting balance of power out in the Asia-Pacific region.
We have that summit coming up between the new president of China, Mr. Xi, and President Obama. What do you think could come of that in the best-case scenario, or what do you fear might come of that in the worst-case scenario?
Look, it's the initial meeting between these two men in their current capacities. The most important thing is that this becomes the beginning of a real strategic dialogue where we start talking about what role China is going to play in meeting various regional and global challenges. We talk about how do we manage the differences and the difficulties in our bilateral relationship, for example, in the economic realm or the cyber realm. But essentially what I'd like to see is the two of them begin to start a series of conversations where the United States and China essentially come to a joint recognition that there's a potential in Asia or more broadly for problems that could arise that would be to neither of our advantage.
My guest on WNYC, Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. And you call your foreign policy doctrine restoration. You elevate this in the book above a foreign policy based on promoting democracy or humanitarianism or counterterrorism, the restoration doctrine. Want to take a minute or two and lay it out for us?
Be happy to. What I essentially want to do is restore some of the traditional balances and priorities in American foreign policy, one we've already alluded to. Less emphasis on the Middle East, more emphasis on the Asia-Pacific region where the great powers are present and where we have the instruments to affect history. Second of all, restoring an emphasis on American domestic policy, not simply to improve our economy and society, but to make sure we have the resources we'll need well into the 21st century so we can act and lead in the world. So I want to restore the foundations of our power, and I want to restore some of the more traditional emphases in what it is we try to do at home and abroad.
Your book is called Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. And this is where you wade into the domestic policy waters that have everyone so stuck, historic gridlock and the looming long-term debt. You served under Carter, Reagan, and both George Bushes. Is it really worse than in the past?
Every once in a while, I think we're all guilty of looking at the past and dressing it up a little bit. But yeah, I actually do think it is. I do think the degree of polarization is greater. I think when one looks at the political process, it is harder to get compromise through the system. The debate has become less civil and less productive. The media coverage is, if anything, more divided than it was historically. Parties are weaker. So yes, I do think it has become decidedly more difficult to govern than was historically the case.
Are you in the camp that thinks polarization is a Washington phenomenon that fails to reflect the general public's interest in compromise, or more in the, say, George Will camp that says we live in a genuinely polarized society with Americans living and praying and going to school among their political and ideological own and electing the Congress that reflects our real American divisions?
The short answer is both. I do believe we become more polarized as a society. We increasingly watch or listen to the media that reflects our views. Many of us live in neighborhoods or states that are actually fairly one-dimensional or less multidimensional than they used to be. So I think to some extent we as a country have become slightly more divided and polarized. But I also think Washington makes a bad situation worse because of the way we fund our politics, because of the weakening of political parties. So and because also of the strength of special interests. I mean, the vote the other day on the background checks, I thought was quite illustrative that you had a general preference of 85-90% of the people for the legislation. You had passionate opposition on the part of, say, 10-20% of the population. And the minority that was passionate overwhelmed through their representatives the majority that had a general preference. And I think that's quite also indicative of our political process.
You identify yourself in the book as a Republican, but mm-hmm. this is not the Republican Party you grew up in. You've probably read the Mann and Orenstein book that blames radicalization of the GOP for the lion's share of the problem. How much do you think the problem is there or more really on both sides?
I think it's on both sides. And in any case, I'm not persuaded it's a terribly useful path to go down to try to attribute responsibility or blame. I could argue it, if you will, contextually, in which our parties to some extent reflect some of the fundamental changes in our society. Or I can say, or this or that piece of legislation, I think this party is more to blame. Clearly, Democrats have made it hard to deal with certain types of entitlement reform or reining in public service unions. Clearly, Republicans have had a lot to do with some of our fiscal problems or other challenges. I think there's more than enough responsibility to go around there.
So how do you break through this gridlock that has most of the smart people stumped? Any new ideas?
Nothing fundamental. I hope it doesn't take a crisis, and that would be the worst of all outcomes, where we're forced to make changes under fairly draconian terms. One possibility is what you might call a pushback model, and by that I mean where people don't like the fact that special interests are dominating our political process, be it the NRA on gun control or the AARP, say, on entitlements. You have Americans beginning to organize against them and the kinds of things that the mayor of New York City is talking about doing in the gun debate. I can imagine, if you will, having competing or countervailing special interests working some of these issues from the ground up. And if that's the case, suddenly it becomes safe or dangerous in different ways for politicians to come out on this or that side of an issue. The other approach is top down. And I haven't given up on the possibility of presidential leadership, and maybe I'm being overly romantic here, but a president who combines some of the big picture abilities, say, of a Reagan or an FDR, and some of the arm-twisting abilities of a Lyndon Johnson, I actually think could still make Washington quite governable. So the idea that it's hopeless is simply not a conclusion I'm prepared to sign on to.
People who defend President Obama say the LBJ arm-twisting analogy is false and unfair because he had a Democratic Congress in both houses and Obama has a structurally resistant House. What do you think about that?
Well, to some extent. On the other hand, what were there, five or so Democrats who voted against the gun control legislation? And if all five of them had voted for it, it's quite possible you could have gotten more Republican votes. And I think then you have to ask yourself, did the White House make clear what would be the political consequences of that vote going against the president? Or this president also, I thought, took the correct step of bringing into existence the Simpson-Bowles Committee on Fiscal Reform. But then after he brought it into existence, he essentially orphaned it and he distanced himself from it and he wouldn't embrace their proposals. And again, it shows to me that, you know, there's a potential for presidential power that we simply haven't seen exercised.
And can I ask you to put your foreign policy hat back on for our last
Sure.
30 seconds and just give me a quick view on Syria, which you acknowledge in the book as a complex problem. Is John McCain more right, in your opinion, to want to send U.S. arms to the rebels, or is President Obama more right to resist?
I think John McCain is right that we should be prepared to send advanced arms to selective rebels, to those we believe hold agendas we can live with. But I also believe President Obama is right to put a ceiling on U.S. involvement there. It's not our only or it's not our principal involvement in the Middle East. It's certainly not our only or principal involvement in the world. We've got to look at it against the totality of our interest in the region, out in Asia, in the Pacific, and here at home. So I think the president's right to stay aloof, but I would be willing, if we're not willing to get involved directly, I do think we should be more willing to get involved indirectly.
Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, his new book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, The Case for Putting America's House in Order. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.